Let's start with the March meeting. First, we're going to start with a discussion about classification of liabilities as current or not current. What do we look forward to?
Start. Okay. So that is paper 29. And the papers, both the papers for this meeting discuss one of the criteria for classifying liabilities as non-current, which is that the entity has the right to defer settlement for at least 12 months after the reporting period. And the first paper, which is 29A, discusses the impact of equity settlement features on the classification. The staff recommend that the board refines the exposure draft proposals as described in paragraph 30 of paper 29A. And that would be to clarify both the existing IAS 1 requirements and the proposed amendments. And the questions for you, do you agree that the board should refine the exposure draft proposals as described in paragraph 30? And if so, would you like the staff to undertake any further targeted consultation on the refined proposals, which would probably largely be to get a better idea or more information about the impact?
Thank you. I agree with the staff's recommendation. As long as the objective of classification is to provide the information about the duration. But there are some other views. The purpose of the classification is not just for duration information. You should provide more information about the liquidity or what is the settlement is all about. But that, as long as we stick to the information we are going to provide is duration, I agree with the refinement. shown in the paragraph 30. However, as I said, there are other views, so it is a good idea to have a consultation. So my question is, what kind of consultation are you going to conduct? What is the difference between re-exposing this draft? So without exposing, re-exposing this draft, you want to get the reaction. What is the majority view? So I was a bit confused.
Well, I'll tell you what I was thinking about in the way of targeted consultation. We didn't think, as I've said in paragraph 31, that this was a matter that required re-exposure. It's a very narrow topic, and they're not fundamental changes, and we're clarifying something that had been exposed in the exposure draft with the basis for conclusions. But my sense was that because quite a few respondents didn't fully understand the proposals and their impact, we didn't get as much comment on the practical impact as we would normally do on a proposal. And so I was thinking, well, if who would have the best idea about what the practical impact might be, and I think it might be the large accounting firms. Mm. And so maybe asking them, showing them the refinements and asking them about it, and perhaps that's something we could do via the IFRIC members, the Interpretations Committee members. So that was the sort of consultation with a view to getting a better idea of the practical impact, if you wanted to do anything more, but you might feel you've got enough feedback already.
I also agree with finalising the proposals in the way that the staff recommends in the paper. I think that the way that it's been analysed and the proposed clarification in terms of the interaction between the existing requirements and the proposed amendments makes sense to me. And when I read the feedback, I think most people seem not to disagree. They just thought we could be clearer in terms of what we were proposing, and I think what you're proposing to do in the redraft would help with that. I also think that this focus on duration is appropriate. I think it's what IS1 already focuses on, given my understanding and also my understanding in the explanation of the basis paragraphs, etc., that support the existing words in IS1. And personally, I think it follows sort of logically from our classification model more generally as an IAS 32 classification, because if you have instruments which can be classified as liabilities that will only ever be equity settled, because they're going to be settled for 100 worth of your ordinary shares, the only way you can think about maturity is by looking at sort of duration, the way that it's been expressed in the paper. And so I think it follows neatly with our classification model to take this approach. So I agree with the proposal. I wouldn't make a huge deal of the outreach. I think it's just confirmation to see whether there's any bigger impact than what we anticipate. And so I think something sort of measured using the interpretation committee or something like that would be a sort of proportionate way, just to make sure we understand the effect of what we're doing.
Thank
you, Hans. I also agree with staff's proposal. I think although the existing BCA 38P already mentioned this clarification, but I think it is not enough. It's better to include those, you know, a clarification in the standard itself. I have some observation or some need some clarification. One is about the right to defer settlement of the liability. I noticed that the paragraphs, existing paragraphs 69D, did mention that that right should be unconditional. And we already removed that unconditional from the sentence. And I noticed that the exposure drafts also mentioned that. The reason is that we say that we observed that the right to defer settlement are really unconditional, but actually we didn't seek specific comments on this issue. But I think it's a change, so it's better to mention or clarify this change further. And also because we are going to do, I agree with, we are going to do some target consultation. I think it's better to consult this, you know, this issue with regard to some this issue to some stakeholders, because it really have some, maybe have some consequences to some stakeholders, some preparers. So this is one observation. Second one is that based on the paragraph 16 and 17, there's an example there with regard to the equity settled obligation and will be classified as liability. And it, the example mentioned that in which cases this kind of equity settlement settled obligation will be classified as current obligation. But there is a condition that means the an entity, there is an obligation to deliver those instruments should be within 12 months. So I think it's better to clarify further or to emphasize that those delivery of equity instruments should be within 12 months, then they will be classified as current liability. And finally, one recommendation about the order of the settlement, different forms of settlement. Currently, we got order is that cash first, and then equity instrument, then other assets and services. I would like to prefer that cash, other assets and services, and equity, you know, instrument. I think it's better, because and it is also consistent with the basis and conclusion of the exposure draft. We did mention the orders, those different forms. Yeah. I think to keep it consistent each other, it's better to change the orders of different forms of the settlement.
Yeah.
Okay. Councillor Azar.
I also agree with the analysis of the staff and the recommendation in paragraph 30. So I think you have identified the elements which blur the misunderstanding of people in reading the statements. But I would eventually recommend that instead of refining further, as you explain in little I and little 2I, I think that might be a quicker way of saying, you know, that the terms that matter in the classification are those of the instrument that are classified as a liability in IFRS literature. And you could also add that in contrast, whatever is classified as equity, those terms would not matter. Because I'm afraid that if we build up on correcting a misunderstanding that comes from something that wasn't clear, we get into too much detail and don't project to people, in fact, the big picture.
So we've identified an underlying principle and try and get that principle in instead of explaining the various bits.
Instead of trying to correct the misunderstanding, you know, just bring it a few new wording. And with that wording, I mean, the I-32 can evolve in one way or the other. This will always be valid.
Mary?
I think, like others, I think the staff has done very good work in terms of trying to respond to the confusion that people felt, and I think reading this paper is pretty understandable, you know, why they might have seen it, but potential conflict, so good work sorting that out. I did think when I read and I support how you're proposing to deal with it, two comments, and one might be a bit in tension with Francoise's recommendation for a different reason. When I looked at paragraph 19 and 18, 19 in the discussion of duration, the thought I had in respect of that is that we're talking about the duration of the instrument that was issued, not the duration of the funding of the entity. And so I think we have to be cautious about how much we bang on about duration as the ultimate test or objective, because I would hate for a term, you know, an explanation that we offer to become a principle that some see as creating another anchor that might be used to argue is in conflict with other explicit requirements. In fact, I think duration in the context of the specific instrument, not the funding of the entity more generally, is the explanation. I think we should not try to tinker with the words very much in the standard, but rather use the basis for explaining, you know, why there might have been confusion and why we thought that the two discussions were compatible rather than in conflict, and not try to modify too much. So if what Francoise was suggesting was a modification of the text of the standard to articulate kind of an overarching principle, then I might have some concerns about that. But if it was more in the nature of explanation and the basis for conclusion, I think we can do that, but I do think we should be focused on emphasizing it's the instruments that's issued, not the general notion of duration of capital. And while I don't object to you testing it as, you know, you were suggesting with the interpretation committee as, you know, our body that deals with the application of standards, I'm not sure I feel the need to run this.
Bonsoir.
I would like to supplement after what Mary has said, because I think the basis for conclusion itself is very confusing. Mm-hmm. So if without amending or striking a number of paragraphs that are included there, I think people won't find their way there. I can't see, I mean, it's not such a principle. I mean, to mention that whatever is classified as a liability, I mean, the terms that have to be taken into consideration as those of the liability that are classified
as such. As I understand it, Francois's principle is that if the obligation is classified as equity, you ignore it for the purposes of classifying the liability. But if the obligation is itself, if the equity settlement feature is classified as a liability, it does count. If it's classified as an equity component, it doesn't count. It's not so much the principle of duration, it's more the principle of how we've classified the obligation as either liability or equity.
And the problem that we have in the wording is that we say the terms of a liability that could blah, 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 do not affect its classification. In fact, what is classified as liability always matters. Because we, we use the liability as being designed, in fact, describing a debt instrument that has an equity component, which is not, as a whole, a liability, only part of it. Then, nevertheless, we say terms of the liability are ignored. And in fact, I think the terms, what we are aiming at is that the terms of what is classified as a liability in IFRS is always considered.
I agree with that as kind of a general discussion point, but I do worry in part because IS1 is an old standard, and every time we try to take something out or put something in, it becomes more complicated. And if we were to do a more significant rewrite, then I think we do have to worry about the unintended consequences concern. So I mean, I think we all want to head in the same place, and we understand that the staff has responded to comments we got on the consultation that said you're proposing words for the standard that are inconsistent with other words that are in the standard, and you have explained why they're not inconsistent because they apply in different circumstances. I think it is, and maybe we just ask you to think about how best to capture that rather than try and give you drafting at the table, but I think I do have a concern about trying to rewrite pieces of what is not the best example of our drafting in terms, standard setting, because it's grown up over many years with lots of tweaks. But I do have some caution about rewriting it.
I understand.
Okay. Chang Vu.
Thank you. I agree with you. There's no point about your recommendation. Everything is okay. But the clarification to clarifications, that's related to paragraph 30 and C.
Yep.
Aligning the terminology.
Yep.
You said referring in both cases. Here, both means the paragraph 69D and new amendment.
Yes.
That's
the both.
Both, okay. Yes. So that means we are going to change in the paragraph 69D, by the issue of equity instruments, you are going to say that's by transfer, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But also probably put in something about what the meaning of transfer is.
All right.
As in 30C of the paper. So the term transfer applies to any means of delivering the entity's equity instruments to the counterparty, including issuing new instruments.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I agree with that they are replacing the issue by with the transfer. It's okay. However, one concern is that there FASB is a proposal. Mm-hmm. Based on your good analysis on FASB's new proposal, mm-hmm. that was made in 2017. Mm-hmm. That's after our exposure 2015. So what I'm saying is that FASB's proposal is their distinctive, their differentiated issue,
yep.
and transfer. I mean, they're issuing new equity so they can avoid a kind of a payment of some kind of cash or current assets with from their kind of just giving old asset. Mm-hmm. Old equity, to the counterparty. So they are differentiating these two activities on this equity instrument. So,
To be honest, I'm not sure they are differentiating. This is all the wording they have, and they've used the word issue, but I don't know that they discussed necessarily.
You sure, transferring?
The extent to which, how broadly issue would apply. So I know they have a different word. I don't know the consequences.
Read more into it.
Yeah, I don't know the consequences of that different word because I don't know what they intended issue to mean or how broadly they expected it to apply.
Tom?
Ruth, I think FASB have a different principle going, but I'm not going to go there. I read it, but I won't pretend to want to present it.
Yeah.
Just a thing on what Francois said is I agree with 30. We're going to see new wording in 69D, are we?
There will have to be some amendment to 69D to clarify that it's the only options we're talking about are those that are classified as equity.
Okay, now, yeah, so...
I don't know how we draft that, whether we pull the sentence out and put it with in another paragraph where we discuss this in a paragraph along with the new sentence or something. I don't know, but yes.
Yeah, so I guess my one comment is just... So I agree with 30. I think it's going to be difficult because the existing 69D is unclear. Yeah. And as Mary said, though, there's always so how you're going to walk that tightrope, good luck. We're looking forward to seeing you bring it back.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing, though, is might be clear about we do appear, I think FASB have a different principle than we do.
Mm-hmm.
It would be good if that was made clear in whatever you bring back. I don't think we should be doing anything different than what we are doing now, regardless of what FASB is doing. But I think we should be aware of what FASB is doing so that everybody understands the difference.
Sure.
I'm not sure anything's coming back, by the way. But I just wanted to say that I quite like Francoise's idea because I think that it's perhaps what's sitting behind the words we have in paragraph 69.
We're almost there with the new sentence.
And I think it gets more at the heart of what we're trying to target, and that is a new paragraph. So if we were to tinker with that, it wouldn't be changing the existing IS1. I think we still might need to do something with 69D or whatever the existing one is, but I think maybe Francoise is hitting on what it is that's really behind all of these words in 69, drafts of paragraph 69.
Overall, I think we are in agreement with the staff recommendations.
And say good luck.
14. Joan, are you good, or do you want to sum up sort of your next steps?
In terms of refining the proposals, it will be broadly as agreed. The drafting is obviously something we have to work on. I was thinking of presenting something like this paper to maybe the Interpretations Committee members and just checking with them that there would be no major impacts that we're not aware of, so that we have an understanding of the effects. This is the last of the technical issues, so we're getting quite close to finalising the proposals now. So it would be that from this we can then move on to just wrap up everything.
Okay, then we can move to paper 29B.
In February 2016, the board tentatively decided to clarify that in assessing an entity's right to default settlement of liability, compliance with any conditions in a lending agreement should be assessed as at the reporting date, even if the lender will not test the entity's compliance until a later date. The paper discussion how to assess whether the entity complies at the reporting date with a condition relating to its financial performance for a period extending beyond the reporting date. The staff recommendation is in the paragraph 16. The staff recommend adding that entities would be judged to comply with a condition as of the reporting date if its financial performance for a period of equal length ending on the reporting date indicate it is complying with the condition. Do you agree with the staff recommendation?
Constanza?
I agree with the thrust of what you are heading to, but I have some reservation because I mean, you illustrated very well in the paper different ways in which people could test whether the condition would be met when the time comes. And you finally retained a solution, if I read it well, that considers the past only. And I think it would be a pity to lead people to ignore a very possible future outcomes that could contradict, in fact, what the past has revealed. So I would prefer to leave the possibility of looking into the future open.
So you're saying allowing or requiring them to look into the future?
I think it should be considered.
What we've tried to do, and I don't know if the wording actually pulls it off, is to just say enough that people realize that they don't have to compare their actual 9 months of performance with some requirement for 12 months. And to look backwards as a guide to how they are doing in that process. So in deciding how they are going to make the comparison, they have to look at the past. We tried to not be too prescriptive in the wording, so that if something had happened that was a real one-off that wasn't going to be repeated in the last quarter or something, they wouldn't be forced to take what they had and exactly if it was going to give a misleading answer. But so we were trying not to force people to a wrong answer. To give them just enough manoeuvre, really.
Maybe it's the way I read your suggestions, but when I read that is a period of equal length ending,
yeah,
to me that's all in the past.
Yeah, that's how I read it.
Yeah.
And it says in a way it would be judged to comply, providing that in the past it's met.
Yeah.
And to me, if they have elements that are give a good look into the future and that would contradict that past reference, I think that they should take that into account.
Gary?
Thank you. And I agree with the direction of travel on here. As I read paragraph 16, I'm not sure if I agree with Francois or disagree. But it says, if a condition relates to a measure of financial performance for a period extending beyond the reporting date, the entity would be judged to comply. It doesn't say that's the only thing you look at. And that's how I would read that as a practitioner. It says, okay, last 12 months I comply, I'm done. But it doesn't say I can't look to something else. And I think that's in there, by its absence of saying you can't look to something else. No. If you want to clarify it and here are the basis, I guess we can deal with that. But I don't read that as the only way you would do it. I think in paragraph 13, it says this is probably infrequent. I think companies, the way you report under your no knowledge at default or illustrate when the treasurer signing your compliance certificates, usually these data agreements, they lay out exactly how you're going to test it, what periods, what counts, what doesn't. And you sort of give your schedule showing how the numbers add up. And so I suspect it is laid out pretty well how the test or the compliance proof will be done. And I think the test might very well be not tied to the year-end closing cycle, but nor is the tax return, but you still certify your tax provision. Lots of things occur or proven or trued up after the fact. And I don't see the fact that you might be doing the test later or for a different period, particularly unusual. Again, the debt instruments spell it out. The other thing I would assert is if there's an issue or a concern on compliance, this is a very heavily inspected internal calculation. And no one wants to have an event of default or event of noncompliance. And if you see it coming, you intend to make a phone call to your bank counterparty to heads up and you start working it. So I don't, wouldn't make too big of a deal of this because you point out 13. You don't think it's that frequent. I agree with direction of travel, but I 16. I don't read that as the only way you could do it, and just as a way.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to congratulate the staff from the Asia Oceania office. You made a good job. By the way, I disagree with staff. like Francois said, I disagree with incorporating such a mechanical rule into the principle-based accounting standard. So although the intention is clear, but if you write down like you wrote in the paragraph 16, so it could be a quite mechanical rule. So there are a variety of business in the world. Say, for example, some business have business only in January. Most of the business concentrated in January. So suppose last year's January was not very performing accidentally, but you are quite sure that incoming January's revenue is already performing. And then when it comes to make a financial statement, if you strictly follow your rule, then you have to classify the liability to the current basis. It's really misleading. So there are variety of cases. So I'm not saying that we should include a forecast, but to making such a quite mechanical rule itself doesn't really work. So therefore, we should make some more principle-based rules. You have to look at the annual year basis performance or something like that. That is my view.
Can you just, there are two different interpretations of the same paragraph going around. Can you just confirm which one the staff intended?
Well, I can tell you what I thought it meant.
You can show us which words get you there.
Yes. I thought what it would mean was that by putting in would, we were offering one way in which you could meet the criterion.
An expedient to get you there that you could consider
because
using.
Because what I was concerned with doing was making it clear that whatever you did, you didn't have to compare your 9 months with what they required in 12 months. So if what we mustn't do is say the entity must comply at the reporting date with the condition, if people interpreted that as meaning in the 9 months that have already expired, I need to have met the 12-month condition. So I was hoping for was something that said you didn't have to do that without then saying to people exactly how they would do it. And I thought one way that would be to say if one way of doing it, that would be a better thing to say, would be to say one way of doing this would be to consider whether your performance for the same period ending on the reporting date indicates you will comply.
Sue?
I certainly didn't read the words that way because it says an entity would be judged to comply if you meet the condition. Yeah. That to me is a black and white, this is the test.
Mm-hmm. Would be judged only if.
It doesn't say only.
It doesn't say only. But this means I've complied.
A way.
Okay. It says I've complied.
But there's other ways.
But I was going, This in isolation, let's say that I had a 5-year instrument, which was a 5-year instrument, no questions asked, unless I don't meet a ratio in 3 months' time. Mm-hmm. So that's my only question mark in terms of whether it's current or non-current. If at the reporting date I look at my 12 months and I comply, then I would say an entity would be judged to comply with the condition. Because for that 12 months you've met it, tick.
Yep.
Yeah?
Yep.
And personally, even though I think it's a bit black and white and a bit of a rule, maybe that's appropriate because I know that during the financial crisis, this turned into a massive deal where I know of at least one company where they had a misapplication of current versus non-current in their financial statements, and very shortly thereafter they went belly up. mm-hmm. and they had debt that had been shown as non-current that had turned out to should have been classified as current. So if people get this stuff wrong, it's got massive legal implications mm-hmm. for people. So I think personally it's better to be black and white in a way to say this is what you need to test. I wouldn't leave it as woolly because I think then how are people going to assess it? They're not going to know what we mean.
So I guess my concern, and I read this, I think, the same way Gary did, was that this was providing one circumstance in
that,
which, in that one circumstance, you would automatically be assumed to qualify, and otherwise you could also test. And I think the one that worried me was the circumstance, which is quite opposite to what you've illustrated, yeah. is the circumstance where I have achieved the target in the last 9 months, but I already know that I'm making a loss in the next quarter. Mm-hmm. And it seems like if this were a rule, it would force me to say, even though I already know I'm going to miss the target, I have to pretend like I'm not going to miss the target.
That's fine, but I think we need to be clear how we want the test to be run.
I agree completely with that, and that's why I sort of jumped in, because it was important to clarify what the staff were aiming at, even if we can worry about the specifics of the wording. So I was comfortable with this, and I like the term safe harbour. I was comfortable with this as a safe harbour. If I've got no real way to predict forward what's going to happen, I don't want to do that. I can actually take 12 months with 12 months, even though they've got a different end date for the purposes of doing this. So on that basis, I was happy, but I would not be happy with saying you are forced to apply this methodology and ignore any other information that you may have.
Yeah, well, same. Picking up what Gary said, I'd read it as a sufficient condition.
Yeah.
If you do this, you're okay, but there may be other okays. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing is you only really can test this at the end of the year, as I understand it, because as Daryl said, you could even run a loss. You could run a loss. You could be in good shape with one day to go and run a giant loss in the last day and fail. And then at that moment, somebody's going to actually run the test for real. So we're figuring out what to do in December 31 with 3 months to go. One way I thought was really what you want to do is on December 31st, do 9 months plus a forecast, kind of what Daryl said. And a simple forecast is a random walk which says, you know, next one is the same as the most recent one. So you substitute in first quarter last year as my forecast, because that's not a bad place to start forecasting. And then you could adjust for other information. But just applying that really clear, objective forecast, that's a nice, sufficient condition, and I was happy to go with it. But I would never make it a necessary condition because, you know, they haven't violated. And we don't really know what other information is out there. And we actually don't know that they've succeeded.
Well, it's only important if it's a close call.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're so far overachieved, yeah. it almost doesn't matter. But I think I still...
Or you're so far under. That's
or where... so far under, but you've already failed. But the point is that chances are that you have brought... You would be ill-advised not to bring that to your banker's attention.
I would agree. So that's what I'm just saying is that's why I like it as a sufficient. If you get through that one, it's a nice, clear thing, and then there's some judgment otherwise.
I don't understand what you're saying. I don't disagree because I don't understand. So let's say that I'm in my heart, I know that my performance is uncertain, so I know it's uncertain whether at the end of the 12 months I'm actually going to meet the ratio or not. But as at the reporting date, based on the last 12 months, I do meet the test. Are you saying that's sufficient and therefore I can say it's non-current? Because
yes.
that then...
Yeah, that's what I would treat that as...
That's very dangerous for investors. So I don't see how we can call that sufficient. Because that means I'm saying it's non-current because it's a safe harbour. But we know in that case that there's uncertainty about whether in fact it's going to be current.
Yeah. Okay, so I was saying I read 16 as presented as a sufficient condition. That's how I was reading. I was back to how do you want to read 16. That's what I thought you wanted, that it was a way, kind of like Gary said.
So if an entity wants to be, if I met the 12-month test today, I'm allowed to say that it's non-current. But if I was, if I decided that I thought it was better for another reason to say actually it's current, then I can make it current instead. Is that what you're saying?
But this is the what no, the word no, says.
Not what the term is.
I'm trying to understand what the sufficient means.
Oh, okay. You mean a triggering sufficient? Yeah, okay.
So what? So,
because, sorry to interrupt, but because I'm trying to avoid, because it's English, right?
Using could, will, and would.
I think would means exactly what Sue is saying. That's so if I would say that if I meet that in 12 months, I'm done.
It's non-current.
Does not make sense for us to be debating what the staff intent was rather than these words.
But I'm trying to understand what you guys think your alternative reading of the words is.
My understanding at the moment of, and I'm rephrasing your words, I think. But the understanding here is that we've created a safe harbour that says if you've got, and there's a second question on this, but the safe harbour says that you are allowed to use the 12 months to the date you are reporting as a proxy for the 12 months that end at some point in the future.
So if that says you're non-current, then you can be non-current. Absolutely. And you won't get into trouble.
So then there is a secondary question which comes into play here. And I think the reason why this made sense to me is that because otherwise what we're asking an entity to do is to forecast into the future. Mm-hmm. And that forecasting is, we all know, an inexact science. So to what extent are we going to be comfortable relying on somebody's forecast into the future? The one question that's sort of coming up in the discussion around the table is, should we be saying that you're allowed to use this methodology as a safe harbor unless there is something you are clearly aware of that is going to happen in the period until that would indicate that you would come to a different conclusion? And it just feels like that's the problem we've got, is that we're all worrying about the situation in which I think that the 12 months are not representative of the future. Mm. Now, if we provide it as a safe harbor that allows people to get the wrong answer knowingly, that does seem to be a problem.
But also, can I just make sure I understand you? So based on your logic as well, if I ran the 12-month test and it said that I was current, I'm stuck with current, right? I can't become non-current.
Yeah. No.
You have the difficulty here that if I run the 12-month test and I don't believe that is representative of, then I can run another test. We've had the same debate on, I think, other topics too. The reality is there's nothing to prevent you from undoing a test and trying a different test until you get the answer you like. And that's why I think you might need something in there that says you can't ignore information you have to the contrary.
Well, I think we can safely assume that the current wording proposed by the staff will guarantee a lot of confusion. So we need something more precise or more principled. I don't know. Gary?
Yeah. I think Daryl was hitting on it, but I think if this test works, you cannot have willful ignorance of something, a post-balance sheet event, and ignoring that's going to blow it out. I mean, you're in all sorts of trouble. And starting with, you're likely to be having an auditor representation letter saying, I'm not aware of any subsequent events that would affect the carrying values or amounts of the prior balance sheet. I mean, amongst everything else that's going to be working against you. But assuming you're not willfully aware of some true knockout event and it's just sort of business as usual, your estimate of current or non-current is no different than any other estimate closing the books. You're making judgments about open litigation. It's a year before you true up your tax return, and the list goes on about making just dealing with uncertain future events that will in time confirm where you are. It's an estimate, and my estimate now is I'm non-current or I'm current, as the case may be, and this is one of the ways I might be able to look at it, but I just cannot ignore a known future event. That's willful ignorance is, you know, that kills you, quite frankly, you know, in a court of law. If you're aware of it and ignore it. And by the way, you're only buying yourself a limited amount of time, you know, for some months until your compliance has to be done. And you wipe out your credibility on that, you've got much bigger problems than just the non-current classification.
As far as?
I mean, I seem to agree. So not in our understanding of the wording, but at least to where we were. Principal. We would like to head to, so. I wonder whether we could not have what the staff has proposed, but supplementing it with an unless there is evidence. Because, you know, I think it's, you say it goes without saying, and I say it's better if it's explicit.
I think it is explicit, just not in this paragraph, that you just cannot avoid, ignore known events that might affect classification of the balance sheet, but just elsewhere.
There are different
I view this as just a test that might work.
Mary?
Having been keen on being a bit more explicit about how you do this test, I now wonder if it's worth the pain. But I think some things have come out of here that we would want to capture, and that is to acknowledge that there may be circumstances in which the test period doesn't align with the financial reporting period. If that's the case, you've got to apply a test that's relevant. And one thing that would not be relevant is using 9 months of data to test a 12-month performance condition. Just identifying that as something that would be inappropriate, and making the observation that we expect it to be reflective of the information. I'm looking at Sue because I can't think of the words that are in IFRS 9, but information reasonably available, you know, to
reasonable
you.
Reasonable and supportable.
Sorry?
Reasonable and supportable.
Yeah, those ones.
I knew
that. And we could just make the observation that often using 12 months to the reporting date would satisfy that requirement for relevant information, but then just stopping there. I think what I've heard around the board table is concern about, from some people at least, of giving an absolute safe harbor that says, if you do 12 months, it's fine, even if you're aware of something bad coming in the next quarter. And I think I've heard concern about requiring everybody to do a projection of that. So I think it comes back to saying you have to do a relevant test. And one of the things that you've brought out in this paper very well, we want to make sure we capture, is 9 months of data for a 12-month test is not a relevant test. And that you have to, you know, and just observing that one way you can very often do it is that, you know, the 12 months to date, and to stop there. But it doesn't give a safe harbor if you use 12 months.
We could do that. So that would be more to say, in these situations, you apply a relevant test, and that wouldn't mean comparing 9 months with 12, although obviously I wouldn't say 9 months with 12, but yeah. And you're not expected to compare 9 months with 12,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that wouldn't be a relevant test.
Right.
But go no further.
Well, I think in terms of saying what does relevant mean, it's not 9 months with 12, and it's not ignoring information that's, say it again, Sue.
Unless supportable.
Reasonable and supportable. So what has to be reasonable and supportable?
You can't ignore reasonable and supportable information without undue cost.
Well done.
Yeah. Does that come from somewhere?
IFRS
9.
Implementation.
That's why I kept queuing Sue.
Martin?
I mean, what Mary said, but 9 months for 12 could already be relevant. So I would also not go this route, because if you have already achieved in 9 months and don't have an indication that you have a bad first quarter, that could be already sufficient and could be a relevant test already for this. So, and wouldn't it be better to do nothing on that? That is what would be my conclusion, because man, it is always you have to give a judgment on the reporting date, okay, what is then the condition, and to be silent on that, because there can be so many situations. And I think for standard settings, it is too.
Couldn't you have said that a half an hour ago?
My only concern is, I mean, having read this, I was convinced that the safe harbor does provide, the safe harbor as we have caveated, does provide some sort of useful mechanism to use, simply because sometimes you're going to get to the end of the year and you don't know what's going to happen for the next 6 months. And so having something that you can look to, otherwise I think you're going to have to end up concluding to be prudent or conservative or whatever the word is, that you're always going to fail the test if you don't have information looking forward over the next 6 months. So I struggle without having something that suggests that you can do this, the 12 months to date are a proxy for the 12 months to some other date.
Well, if we're silent, aren't people just
left having to make an assessment, which I think is what Gary's saying, an assessment as at the reporting date of whether you think you have the right to whatever the words are about not having to settle within 12 months in a sensible way.
And why should we give guidance here? I mean, people have to give assessments on the future on loan loss provisions now, expected losses. They have for insurance to give. I mean, why do we give now a specific, I don't know, what is it? I don't think it's necessary. People have to make this judgment at reporting date, and that's what it is.
Who votes with Martin's proposal?
I vote. Okay.
No,
you
go wrong with that, I think.
No, 10. There you go. Uh-huh. Again, half an hour earlier for next time.
So that just means saying you assess it as at the reporting date and then including no further requirements.
You just say go figure it out yourself. Yeah. Okay. We are going to.